You're tuned in to another installment of General Protection Fall. It's the source of your talk you can use. On tonight's show, the coronavirus is starting to cause fallout across the tech industry. The Smithsonian has released over 2.5 million images that you can use for free. TurboTax is spending billions on a free tax prep competitor. And Apple won't let bad guys use iPhones in movies, according to one director. It's all coming up on today's General Protection Fault. This is General Protection Fault, the source of computer talk you can use. My name is Jeremy Smith, host of the program. You can find out more about it on our website at gpfault.com, facebook.com/gpfault, and on Twitter at gpf_radio. Joining me today is our, I don't even remember what I called you.
I think it was resident historian.
Resident historian. That's right. Jeremiah Schrock joining us today. Ivan took a tumble down the stairs, so he is not able to make it in today. But hopefully he'll heal up enough that we can wheel him in there and stick him in front of the microphone.
Perfect.
In the meantime, though, he's playing a lot of Division 2, so I'm very happy about that. That's one of my favorite games right now, is Division 2. In case you're trying to think of a game to play, it was recently $3. It's a great game if you like to play metagames, where you just spend all your time collecting gear and adding numbers together and then dividing numbers and then playing the game for 5 minutes and then continuing the adding numbers game. Love that game.
And that's your favorite type of metagame, isn't it?
It goes hand in hand with the other metagame I play, which is the collect as many games as possible on various game platforms game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, speaking of that, this is a computer talk you can use. Fans of the Epic Game Store, which there aren't a lot of them, but there are some, they've just added a feature. You can finally wishlist games on that service.
Wow.
So if you want a game, you can add it to your wishlist.
It's almost like that was an afterthought.
I don't think almost like qualified. I think it definitely was an afterthought.
Okay.
It was not a considered, it was not something important for them to focus on, I think. That's my interpretation at least.
Okay.
So first story, and covering like this is a bunch of different stuff. It's the coronavirus, which is going on right now. And we were talking about this before we came on and pretty much most of the week. It is causing a major effect in everything right now. I mean, not to mention, and this is something I want to throw out and just see what people think. And of course you can let us know at gpfault.com. But Jeremiah, why is everyone buying toilet paper?
I think everyone's buying toilet paper because they want to make sure that they can still use the facilities if, for whatever reason, the facilities that make toilet paper, I don't know, get hit by coronavirus.
Okay.
Is that not the response you were looking for?
I have no idea why. I mean, why are people buying bottled water? Fine. I get that. That always goes in an emergency. Duct tape? Sure. But no one's talking about duct tape or bottled water. They're talking about toilet paper. That's all the jokes. Is there something that I'm missing?
Well, I can tell you that I went to purchase some goods a few weeks ago.
Right.
So not that I'm a stocker or a prepper so much as I just want to make sure I have the bacon and eggs that I want.
Sure.
For breakfast.
The specifics. Right.
You know, chocolate, wine, the essentials,
right, folks. Your bonbons.
And toilet paper is just one of those essentials. I don't think you need to stock up on it.
Right.
But I think having enough to get you through. I mean, it's like the old Seinfeld episode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't got a square to spare. You know, we don't want to go to the bathroom and not have toilet paper.
Sure.
So I think people are taking out their anxieties.
By purchasing toilet paper. Have you seen this? There's this video going around. You can find it on Reddit where it's a time lapse of a toilet paper aisle in a major store, like maybe a Walmart or something like that. And it just shows over 1 hour how people just descended on it like locusts. And in an hour, all the toilet paper was gone. And it was just like hundreds of people going down this aisle, like clamoring to buy toilet paper.
I think buying toilet paper in a certain quantity makes sense, but you can't eat toilet paper.
Right.
And for somebody who lives in Alaska, which is, of course, where this show is aired.
Right. Or, well, it's based.
Where it's based, where we live.
We're everywhere.
Everything has to come up to us from Seattle.
Correct.
So I'm not really worried about running out of toilet paper so much as, you know, food.
Right. That's when I'm more nervous about that.
I'm not even worried about water because we have tap water. That's right. Not going anywhere.
And we have snow.
And we have snow.
If we really want to be technical.
Oh, for sure.
Right.
But food to me is the bigger issue. And I'm not saying to stockpile MREs. I don't think this is an apocalyptic prepper situation.
No.
This is, if you really like bonbons, you should probably get a couple extra boxes of bonbons. So if the flow of consumer goods is impacted by this, that you can, go a week or two or three without, having to root around in the refrigerator for that two bits of celery
that
old mayo
that no one touches. Right. Like it's behind the baking soda. That's how far back it is in the refrigerator. So the WHO has declared the new coronavirus a pandemic as of today. It's the first one since the H1N1 influenza A virus in 2009. Remember what that one was called? The 2009 virus? H1N1?
Was it swine flu?
In the U.S. it was called swine flu.
Okay.
I did research because I don't ever do that in the show. But H1N1 was actually a combination of the North American swine influenza, North American avian influenza, human influenza, and swine influenza that's typically found in Asia and Europe. That's why it was called H1N1. But since we're in America and it had swine flu in it, and it's from North America, we just call it swine flu, even though it wasn't just swine flu. It was four different strains that made up H1N1.
So that was a really nasty jambalaya, is what you're saying.
A disgusting jambalaya.
Very disgusting.
That actually killed many people. And what was interesting is who declared it a pandemic, and then approximately 3 to 4 months later, it said the pandemic has ended.
I don't remember there being nearly this much hoopla or worry with H1N1 than we've had for coronavirus. What do you think?
I think, and this is something that I was actually talking to my wife about, and I think what it comes down to is because the coronavirus is so communicable. That's the biggest issue. Even though it's not, they're like, only this number of people have died, or it's just like a hard flu is what people are saying. It's like, okay, I can understand that point of view, but the trick is not everyone can survive it because it's so communicable. It basically will live for longer. It's very quickly getting into other people's systems, no matter what you try to do to contain it. And there's an excellent story in Washington Post about the one case of coronavirus that came in that was under complete quarantine and control, and it still got out and still infected people. And now, the state of Washington is on a state of emergency because of that. It doesn't matter if it's not necessarily going to hurt you, but it may hurt someone younger than you or someone older than you or someone who get sick a lot. There's lots of potential people that it won't hurt. And you may be fine, but you are then carrying it like a plague bearer, like a skaven or something.
Like a skaven. Absolutely.
Yeah, just carrying the pestilence further. And that's why, I think they have started to cancel things. That's what I want to talk about next is just the sheer amount of things that have been canceled. So you've got Entertainment Software Association canceling E3.
Which is huge.
It's the first time they've canceled since ever.
So they didn't cancel it for swine flu.
No, they did not. They are canceling it for coronavirus. They are also canceled the GDC, the Game Developers Conference, very big gaming conference. They've canceled esports competitions all around the world. They're all being played online, here's the thing. I don't think I would ever go to an esports competition and sit in the crowd and watch someone play League of Legends. So I don't see this as a bad thing, but that's just me. I'm sure there are people who would love to see their favorite League of Legends team play in person, and now they can't. So you can only watch online. So I can understand that, but I'm also, 6 to 1, half to the other. And the other thing, South by Southwest was canceled. That was taking place in March, though, so that makes perfect sense. In June is when E3 takes place. A lot of these organizers, though, are saying they're going to do stuff online. So all these different conferences are canceled, like the Mobile World Phone Conference was canceled last month. They're doing stuff online, doing releases online. Microsoft, Sony, Nintendo, Warner Brothers Interactive, they all said they're going to do online mini conferences where they do all their announcements. You go to their website and you can see it. Some of it will be streaming on Twitch, things like that. So it's interesting to see how we're dealing with this situation when people are unable to gather in areas. How do we deal with that? And I think President Trump just recently put a ban on travel. from Europe?
This is one of the really rare shows where we are talking about something that just broke.
Right.
Like we're talking about breaking news.
Yeah, totally.
You picked me up and I was like, oh, I read 20 minutes ago this thing had happened.
Right.
So the president decided to limit all travel starting Friday from Europe. Not the United Kingdom, which, as some of you might know, is no longer part of Europe, technically,
right,
with Brexit.
They're still waiting for the ink to dry.
Right. The invisible ink to dry.
Right.
So travel from Europe is being squashed for the next 30 days starting on Friday.
Okay. I know, semi-related, India on March 13th is closing its borders, meaning no one's in or out for, I think they were saying until sometime in April. And they're going to, they only allow in certain people under certain circumstances. So countries are basically closing down. They're closing down their lines. They don't want the virus to spread. And one thing that I've been reading a lot of, especially online, is the cost of the test for coronavirus, and the ability to get the test. You have to basically be on death's door and have it to then be tested. And there's so many people being tested right now, and there's a finite number of tests they can run a day safely, because it's not like, you know, you stick it in the microwave and in 10 seconds, oh, you've got coronavirus. It doesn't work that way. So recently, as part of the bill that was passed by the U.S. government, U.S. health insurance companies will be waiving copays for testing and will cover the cost of treatment for the coronavirus. This was said by Vice President Mike Pence during a press briefing. And also Medicare and Medicaid will also cover costs without copays. Now, the major insurance companies, which includes Anthem, Cigna, Humana, and Aetna, also said that there would not be surprise billing for costs associated with COVID-19. That's the illness caused by the new virus. So the major insurance companies have also agreed to cover the cost of telemedicine. So Medicare is also covering costs associated with remote care as well. Now, currently there are 1,000 cases of COVID-19 identified in the U.S., and public health officials expect that number to continue to rise.
Well, I certainly think it probably will, with how hard it is to get tested. And like you said, you have to be at death's door.
And then you then have to wait and prove it. And anyway, that's a whole nother show, and probably a whole different type of show from what we do here.
Oh, yeah.
But looking at the tech aspect, and especially looking at this idea of telemedicine, this has been a newer thing that's happened. And I think I've mentioned this on previous shows, but I can go see a doctor locally and say, I'm not feeling good. The doctor's like, oh, you've got the crud, which I'm sure many of you have heard. And then they give you, you know, an antibiotic, or they say, just take this for 7 days. You know, it's going to make you need the bathroom a lot, but guess what? You're going to feel great when you're done. And normally how it goes, and you end up dropping $250 on that. And then you have to buy the medicine on top of that. I mean, that's like a standard doctor visit. And that's with your coverage, because it's not preventative care. It's just going to see the doctor. Mm-hmm. Telemedicine allows you to use your phone or your computer to talk to a virtual doctor who could be anywhere, who's just sitting there churning these things out. And that's anywhere from $40 to $100 based on the type of doctor you're seeing, and get the exact same diagnosis and also get medicine the same way.
And you don't have to go see anyone.
Or wait in a waiting room, which may be full of other people who are sick.
Exactly. I mean, how often have you felt like you went to have a regular checkup and then you got sick after that checkup?
Right.
Well, I was in the waiting room for a half an hour. Maybe I picked something up.
A half hour? What doctor are you seeing?
No kidding, right. So this is great. And I can say, you know, my wife has used Teladoc, which is who Aetna uses.
And that's the insurance company that you have.
Correct. And she thought it was great, really.
And she just holds her phone up and they say, how are you today? And
it's very quick. It's personable enough.
Okay.
And it's good for things that you have had before. Like, oh, I had the same crud last year. I would like to use this medication that I used last year. And they'll say, let me look through your records, because it's all in the cloud. And yep, okay, I'm going to go ahead and give you 2 weeks of that. And if you need more, just let us know.
Right.
So it's 5 minutes, very quick.
And you're just
doing
it.
Good to go.
And you're doing it at home, and you're saving money on top of that. Now, flip side, the dehumanization of medicine. There's no more country doc who comes to your house. There's no more, you know, local provider who only has two or three people that he sees on a regular basis. You basically have to go to a clinic and wait, or maybe get lucky and see your specific doctor if they can fit you in. Otherwise, it's like a 2 month wait. And if you're sick today with the flu, you kind of need something today to help you with it. Otherwise, you're going to spend 2 or 3 weeks in misery and either get over it or get worse in the process, or learn you have something else.
Correct.
That wasn't diagnosed. So I think this telemedicine move is good. It's also dehumanizing, so that's fine. You remember that? I love making bring up this movie because I love movies, but it's Idiocracy, and he goes to see the doctor.
Right.
And the doctor is like a giant machine where you just put in the shape based on how you feel. And then the doctor's like, oh, you put a star in. That means your stomach hurts. Here, take this. And it just drops like a giant economy-sized thing of like milk of magnesia for you to drink. It's like that's the solution. It's like very obvious. It's pre-recorded. There's no one actually there kind of thing. That's obviously the direction we're going in. Even though it's a dystopic look at it. I mean, that's where we're going.
I think it's sort of dystopic. I think it depends on your perspective. And as somebody like you and me who tend to be more introverted,
right.
I don't mind not having to go and see
a
doctor. And it's not quite like you're just punching in what you need and a machine spits it out. You are still talking to somebody.
See, I don't want to have to, here's the thing, I don't want to have to pay because I'm already doing the work for them.
Right.
Like, I have this, this, and this. Last time I took this and felt better. I just want someone to say, okay. And then maybe charge me like a small fee for that, not $40 to $100 for that.
Well, in a perfect world, none of this is
out of
pocket.
We would have an insurance that covers all of our things. Yeah. Imagine that.
And that only works in 50 other first world countries.
Right. Not so, here.
No,
but not here at all. So connected to this, looking at the actual conferences that are closing, do you think it's valid to have an online conference? Does it have the same, I don't know, oomph that going to a conference in person has?
In some ways, yes, and in some ways, no.
Okay.
I think there's going to be a certain type of person that loves the experience. It's like when you and I will go to a Comic-Con.
Sure.
And we go because we maybe want that experience of going to a con. And I think with so many of these events, you know, Coachella or South by Southwest, where it's not just one thing, but it's a whole bevy of things, and there's a lot of people doing special things that are connected to the conference, things that are not connected, that you're getting so much more out of it by going. And you do lose some of that enjoyment, I think, doing it online.
From the interaction.
From the interaction.
Okay.
That said, I think we're already doing something similar to this with Twitch or Discord, where if you have a Patreon, one of the perks for folks is, oh, well, if you're giving me $100 a month, you have access to my Discord, and I do weekly chats with people who give at that level. So you can then interact with those people. You can ask them questions. You can kind of get to know them and vice versa. So I think in some ways, if you have enough money, it can be a much better experience. Whereas if you don't, you're going to be left, you know, watching a YouTube video of an interview of a conference that you couldn't go to that maybe was online and maybe wasn't.
I see. Do you think something like what's happening with like E3 and GDC will become like the next, I don't know, like the next frontier? Because one thing I'm seeing, and this is all connected, and I circular logic all the time, but I have seen probably, not exaggerating, 55,000 articles about how to work from home within the last 2 weeks. Because we have companies from Microsoft to Twitch to, you know, even like Lowe's and Home Depot are saying, if you're sick, don't come to work. Stay home. We will still pay you for your time. You will basically have paid sick leave now, even if you didn't before, because we don't want you infecting the entire workforce.
Correct.
By coming in.
Yeah.
So since so many people will, in the next month or over the next couple months, will be working from home, there's this like, okay, how do I do my job in an office at home? Now, I work from home, and I've done that for the last 6 years. I don't have a problem with this. We've figured this out, you know, through trial and error. But other organizations that aren't really sure what to do or how to do this, do you think there'll be a lot more investment over the next couple months in, you know, telecommuting, connecting through, you know, will more technology be driven because people are now remotely working? And here's the other connected thing, another question to follow up. It's like a part C, I guess, of my 20-part question, is now that people can work from home and, you know, I think in probably 90% of the cases, it will work. Will they have to go back to the office? Can they continue working from home?
I think this is all going to come down to one thing, which is how severe will the coronavirus be?
Okay.
Are we able to nip it in the bud in the next 4 weeks?
Right.
Or is this going to drag on for 6 months where there's not really any change? I think if we go to that 6 month mark, I think you'll start seeing dramatic shifts because there have to be shifts made.
Right.
It's one thing to sort of get by on, well, you've worked retail.
Yeah.
You can get by on a skeleton crew for a couple of days.
Sure.
Maybe a week or two, but it starts to add up. And, you know, you get tired, the other employee gets tired. You just, you cannot keep maintaining the work that you're doing.
Sure.
So rubber meets the road. We're going to have to make a change if it gets worse. If it stays the way it is, or let's say it's dramatically better in the next couple of weeks at the end of the 30-day no-fly to Europe,
right,
then I don't think it will. I do want to say I think this is a really – we're at a really good moment where we might be able to put some of these changes into play that we have been holding off implementing.
Like a social change?
Social changes. And this is something I tell – I think I've said to you and I say to my wife a lot where – and it's very dramatic, but that's sort of the point, is that we don't really want to make change unless there's a gun at our back. Then we'll make the change.
Accurate.
Life or death, then we'll make the change.
Right. Banks are collapsing. Let's give them billions of dollars. Car industry is falling apart. Let's give them billions of dollars. People are dying. Well, wait a minute. Are you sure? No, okay. Yeah. Here's some money that you can use to deal with that.
And even though people have been dying from all sorts of other ailments for forever,
right,
because of this new thing that ultimately will impact the bottom line,
right,
and that's the problem, is the administration doesn't want that to happen. I don't think most people want that to happen.
No.
You don't want to lose your job. You don't want to run out of sick leave. But if we're dealing with a pandemic, that's when you need to step in and say, okay, we need to make these changes. Clearly, providing healthcare for these people for 2 months, let's say,
right,
worked really well. And yeah, we lost a lot of money because of all of these other ripple effects sort of things that have happened. But our people are happier. They seem more keen to work. They have done better from home than they have necessarily here. And this might be that moment that drives change, but only if the coronavirus is really bad. And if it's really bad, then there's a whole host of other things that come with that that you, you don't want. You don't
want to work from home. But there are now zombies outside.
Exactly. Oh, the death toll's 10%.
Right.
Surprise. You know, then there's an issue.
I see. Do you think that specifically with these companies, like not having to drop this money on these tech conferences, they're going to like think of like, you're talking about bottom line, like, you know what? We don't really need to spend $2 million on a 30-foot booth at E3. We did our conference online and we had 20 million people watch it and we got 30,000 pre-orders from that. That's more direct feedback than we've ever gotten from a direct investment at E3. And there has been a trend over the last couple of years, like Microsoft, well, Sony actually especially has spent the last 2 years saying, nope, we're not doing E3. There's multiple companies that have like rival conferences at the exact same time. And for people to know, E3 takes place in Los Angeles, in the middle of Los Angeles, an incredibly expensive and difficult to get to and awkward location.
And you know this because you've been, haven't you?
I've been multiple times, yeah. So I'm wondering if, at least for the tech fallout, something like E3 or these giant gatherings, you know, physically is a mistake. And because of the pandemic, you know what? This may just be the new way we do things. We can do a press release conference. And Nintendo does this. They have their Nintendo Directs, I think is what they're called.
Yep, that's what it's called.
Where they, every couple months, are like, hey, we have a new game coming out. We're going to show you just that game, talk about how awesome it is, offer you 2% off if you get the special Mario pre-order version. They can make it whatever they want, make the message anything they want because they control the message and the means of the message getting out. And then everyone's hyped for it because they're excited about this new Nintendo Direct coming up.
Oh, for sure. I think that this is potentially a death knell for these big conferences like this. Maybe not for Coachella or South by Southwest, but for a tech conference where what you're doing you can do for free.
Or remotely.
Remotely. You know, the cost of doing it in-house as opposed to, you know, flying your crew and paying for a booth, and it's a week. It's a whole thing. Now, of course, that's going to be bad for some of these places that rely on this foot traffic.
Right.
I mean, L.A. is already a busy place. If any place can survive it, L.A. can probably survive it.
Right.
I think really when we're talking about the conferences that might go away, I think it's E3. I think it's any of these game conferences. I think South by Southwest, Coachella.
Is that because of the offerings?
I think it's because of the offerings.
You have a live performance. You have events you can only get and experience in this way. Whereas E3 is like you could maybe play a game demo, but you could potentially release that online.
Exactly.
You could also, you know, maybe see this person speak, but you could also see them speak online. Now, I read that GDC, or the Game Developers Conference, that's more about, it's less for consumers and whatnot and playing demo. It's more for like, hey, Jeremiah made this awesome game. Jerry is this awesome publishing company. We need to meet and talk about how we can make this work. So it's more of like a schmooze. Let's do business. Let's talk to people who are in the same industry and learn from them. So more of like an educational conference, less of like an electronic extravaganza event.
Not everybody goes or is invited to GDC.
Right. It's something like you have to have a reason. You have to pay to go. There's a limited number of press slots to go, those kinds of things.
I think events like that will be fine.
Okay.
I think there's still a lot of value in having that face-to-face interaction. You know, having worked in sales, I mean, you worked in sales as well. There's something to be said for face-to-face, you know, eye-to-eye, physical contact, you know, being able to say, oh, yeah, I know exactly what you mean, because you're picking up on all of these cues that you're not going to just get from an online experience. It's very artificial online, but it's very real, unless you're a great actor in person. And events like this, these sort of schmoozy events, will always exist because there will always be a desire to schmooze with like-minded people.
And what's interesting is GDC delayed itself to October, just like Coachella did. E3 canceled. There's just like straight up, nope, there's no E3 this year. We don't have a plan to do an E3 this year at all. So it makes me think E3 is in this weird position where it's like, yeah, why do we exist? If we can't offer, you know, then since 1995, we've offered this experience people can go to and see and I guess experience is the best way to say it. But if you can't offer that one year, the argument's like, why would I spend that money on you next year when I was able to get by without you this year?
I think it will need to evolve. And I can give you an example of what I think it will need to evolve into.
Okay.
You're familiar. You watch lots of anime.
Yeah.
You're familiar with Comiket.
Yes.
All right. Comiket, to those who are listening, is essentially, I think it's a twice yearly fan-published event where, you know, you have your own
art. In Japan.
In Japan. You have your own art, your own manga, your own light novels, and you publish them. And people come and buy them from you directly. And it's very much, here it's fan fiction and it's online. In Japan, it's real and you print books and
it's a physical thing.
It's a physical thing and it's a whole other beast in Japan than it is really anywhere else. So you go to a Comiket because, oh, my favorite writer is publishing the next installment of the series I follow. But they're really popular and they only printed 200 copies. I have to get there because I'm not going to be able to find it. And they're only available at Comiket. So you're dealing with these exclusives and everything is an exclusive. So I think what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to start building in these exclusives. Like, well, you know, you have to come to E3 because we're offering something you cannot get anywhere else. Mm. Sort of like when I think it's Comic-Con in New York where Pop Funko has limited edition Funkos you can only get at their booth at Comic-Con.
Right.
It's going to have to be more like that.
And that does drive people because I've seen there are Funko collectors who go crazy for, like, I only went to get this one exclusive version of Groot.
Yeah.
Something along
there was 300 of them and I was in line. You know, I got out there 4 hours early and I was $2.99. You know, I've done that for whiskey sales at local stores where they'll have an unveiling event and they'll say, oh, you know, we ordered in X number of bottles of this limited stuff and you have to get in line and it's a big thing because it's exclusive. You can't just go in and get it anytime you want.
And it's kind of fun.
And it's kind of fun. You know, you start to rub elbows with other people and like, oh, I saw you last year. Oh, you were earlier last year. Well, we got here earlier this year. And, you know, you can sort of start to build a kind of quasi-community out of it that I think we will want, even introverts like us, need a community of sorts.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And as much as we love to interact online exclusively, we really like to interact face-to-face. So I think there's always going to be a place for these face-to-face interactions and conventions, but I think they're going to have to go through changes. Otherwise, they will just shrivel up and blow away.
Yeah. No, that seems very accurate. And also something that, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if E3 is scaled back even more next year to the point where it's like, yeah, it's E3, but it's not. And then another year, yeah, we're not going to do it this year. We'll do other events. We'll do smaller events in different locations. More people can attend. Maybe their community events. Because E3 is put on by the ESA, which is the Electronic Software Association. And they have historically advocate for the industry. But in the past, you know, since 2017, E3 has been open to the public. So it not only is it like a business thing, it's also open to the public at the same time. So it's like a Comic-Con, but like a quasi kind of lame way of doing it. Just like, we need to make some money. Let's charge these people to get in here so they can play that next Dead or Alive Volleyball 17 that just came out.
Now, here's a thought. And I don't know what sort of agreements the ESA has with LA, if they're based in LA, if they own the convention center where it's held, like if there's all sorts of red tape that would prevent them from doing this. Why not do pop-up shop? But it's E3. Like, oh, this year E3 is going to be in Seattle. It's going to be in Bismarck. It's going to be
like
in Baltimore.
In these and pop-up shops.
All in these different areas. Because that way, I mean, I live on the West Coast, but I have never flown to LA.
Right.
And I don't really want to fly to LA to experience even more people than is usual in these areas. But if Seattle was having one, or there was one in the Midwest, there was one on the East Coast, it would give people a chance to go that they when they wouldn't normally get to go. And also, if you're based on the East Coast, if you're a game dev over there, or if you're a game dev in the Midwest, oh, I don't have to fly all the way to LA. I can just, oh, we can just drive. It's like a 6-hour drive and we're there. We can save 10 grand doing it. Sure, we'll do it. That sounds good.
That's a smart iterative idea that they could use. I mean, and one of the arguments that's come up is PAX, which is the Penny Arcade Expo, as I think they've renamed it PAX, though. It takes place on the East and the West Coast. So it's and it takes place in the Seattle area. So it's much less expensive. I mean, well, it's all relative. But it's less expensive than having it in the middle of L.A. It's easier to get to. There's more places to stay. And then they also have the similar event that takes place on the East Coast. And it's open for fans. It's for role-playing and board games and, you know, cosplay and also game releases. They've been announcing new games, have playable demos and whatnot. And that started as a totally different beast. But a lot of companies are now using that to announce, like, oh, we have this new game coming out. Come see it at PAX. And one thing that I receive a lot since I do this show is people say, oh, are you going to PAX this year? Because we'll be showing this game at this booth, or we'll be teamed up with these people at PAX. Not a lot of people saying I'll be at E3 because of the sheer amount of money it costs to be at E3. And especially this year, because there is no E3.
There is no E3. So it sounds like they've priced a lot of people out of the market.
Definitely smaller developers. And a lot of smaller developers will bank on, okay, we're saving up all of our advertising budget to have a booth at E3. Hopefully not get sick, because on top of all this, you know, the coronavirus, whatnot, whenever you go to a conference, when you put a lot of people together, there's inevitable sickness.
Of course.
There's always some sickness that gets around. So I am glad on some level that we are, you know, as a society collectively, canceling these major events, because this could be, I don't know what's worse than a pandemic. Is there anything worse than that? A disaster?
I mean, maybe arguably thermonuclear holocaust.
Okay, that's the only thing worse than that.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, it's like, this is probably helping in a way, removing these giant events that just crush bodies together and have them rub up against like the gross, you know, I'm not a germaphobe, but sometimes I think I am when I see how things are, you know, communicated from X to Y, especially with disease based. But then I'm thinking, okay, so that's going away. That's a good thing. Hopefully coronavirus, you know, sorry to people who want to work from home, is something we're able to tackle and deal with effectively within a shorter amount of time, although the experts are saying that's not the case. And that's, again, a discussion for another day. This is not a health show, so we'll dig into that. This is a tech show, though, and our next story comes to us from The Verge and the Smithsonian Institution, which you've been to D.C., right?
I have.
And you've gone, like, there's all these Smithsonian free museums you can go to.
Yes.
Full of just art.
Tons and tons of art.
All kinds of art. And art means not just like, you know, a Van Gogh painting, but like photography, sculptures, you know, Van Gogh painting, of course, plus hundreds of other types of art.
It's three-dimensional objects like books on display or right. aircraft on display. I mean, you can – art is very much a catch-all term for this.
So the Smithsonian Institution is releasing 2.8 million high-resolution images from its massive collection into the public domain, putting them online for anyone to use and download for free under the Creative Commons Zero License, meaning it's free from any restrictions, which means the new General Protection Fall plan to get rich, we download 2.8 million images, print them into a book, and sell it at Comic-Con.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you said that, because that was my first thought when I read this article too, was, oh, this means that you can print picture books and you can use all these photos for your own works
right.
going forward, and that there's nobody can see you can't. They're in the public domain.
Right.
I think this is awesome.
It's a fantastic thing, and mainly because the Smithsonian, you know, this open access online platform will include 2D and 3D images from all of its 19 museums, 9 research centers, archives, libraries, a national zoo. So there'll be pictures of pandas or llamas, as some people we know enjoy both of them.
Yes, they do.
And this is all reported by Smithsonian Magazine. Now, Effie Kapasis, that's Smithsonian Senior Digital Program Officer, said that, quote, being a relevant source for people who are learning around the world is key to our mission. We can't imagine what people are going to do with the collections. We're prepared to be surprised.
Memes.
Yeah.
A lot of memes.
So many memes.
And probably a lot of Etsy shops with various designs printed on t-shirts.
Right. Oh, did you want a nude descending a staircase on a pair of sweatpants that says juicy on the butt? Well, guess what? You can get it now. Now is your time.
That is 100% accurate.
Smithsonian, though, is the latest organization to bring its image collection into the public domain. Not to this Creative Commons Zero license level, though. The Art Institute of Chicago, the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, the New York Public Library have also made thousands of images publicly available in recent years. But this is a massive collection of images that are available. And if you just go to the Smithsonian site, they have Degas' portrait of Mary Cassatt, an image of a Roman glass bottle from 200 BC, the Gilbert Stuart portrait of George Washington, portraits of Pocahontas, Ida B. Wells, images of Muhammad Ali's boxing gear, Amelia Earhart's flight suit.
So we're not talking just pictures of art,
of
paintings or pictures of pictures. We're talking about pictures of three-dimensional objects.
Right.
And maybe I really want to see what the boxing gloves look like. Oh, look, there's a three-dimensional image of it, so I can 3D print my own exact replica of Muhammad Ali's boxing gloves.
And what's kind of amazing about this is there has been this litigious movement, over the last, I don't know, I'd say 5 years, of people who have a blog post something using a picture they think is public domain, and then the owner of the picture is like, nope, that's mine, take it down, or you know what, I'm not even going to ask you to take it down, I'm just going to sue you, and now you have to pay me because you're using my image. There are now 2.8 million images you can choose from for putting up on your blog post, adding an extra picture or something like that to the content you put online. And that's kind of amazing in a way. It's going to, like, yeah, you may not be able to use this exact image that someone took, but I bet there's something similar in the Smithsonian database. And I'm sure someone will come up with a way to quickly search this by keyword. Like, I'm looking for pictures of people who are thinking. Here's 40,000 pictures of someone thinking that are completely free to use. You will never be sued because they all come from the Smithsonian collection.
I think that's probably what's going to happen, and I think that's great.
Do you think there will be people who print out 2.8 million pictures and then sell the entire books?
Do you think that will exist? I don't think so. That's a lot of books, or that would be one huge book.
Well, let's talk about books for a second. So Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, mm-hmm. writer of Sherlock Holmes.
Correct.
His work is in public domain. So you can buy Sherlock Holmes books, but you can also download free versions from the Gutenberg Project. Mm-hmm. Are they different? Are the words different?
It really depends on who you're downloading it from. So I like to troll through Amazon Kindle a lot. We have a Kindle, Kindles, plural. And I like to go through and find, what are the free books? And so what you're getting with a lot of these free books is you're getting rife with quality assurance issues. How about that? You know, formatting isn't accurate. Stuff moves around when it shouldn't. You know, when you have a Word document open and you drag a picture and it just moves the text all over the place? Situations like that.
Okay.
And you could report these things, but again, it's like anything. How many people report a problem unless it's, you know, for every 10 people that actually have the problem?
Right.
How many people are reporting it?
And then how many people will actually then care what your report is? Because it's a free book, why are you complaining in the first place?
Well, because I like to have it's hard to read books that are all messed up,
right,
as far as format goes. And that's
I totally get it, but it's like, why would they then spend time and energy on a free book to fix it for you?
You know, that's something I was thinking about, because I think about side hustles from time to time, and there are a lot of books that are in the public domain where there is not an easily well-formatted version available. And it had crossed my mind, again, being the resident historian,
right.
You know, being academically trained historian.
This is good. I'm gonna remember this eventually.
Where
because it's a historic thing.
It is very historic.
Because you're the historian. Do you want me to keep going in this?
Oh, you absolutely
can. No, go ahead.
Where I had thought to myself, oh, you know, there's a couple of books here that, you know, you look for and they are not available in print. And I don't mean not available online, not available as a hard copy. They are not available anywhere except here is somebody at a museum somewhere who photocopied the book in its entirety. That's all you have.
And there's only one copy and it lives in that museum.
And it lives in that museum. And that digital copy is on Google Books is where I find a lot of these things.
Sure.
And downloading it, reformatting it is something I've thought about doing, and then adding in essentially editor's commentary. So what are you getting from this free book? It's like, well, you're getting an academically trained historian who's reformatted it for you, who this is what he does, mm-hmm. and he adds, you know, editor's notes. Because sometimes I'll read a book and they'll reference, let's say, four people that were contemporaries to them by the last name.
Right.
And I recognize two of them, but I don't know the other two. And so I think, well, if I don't know the other two and I went to college for this, it's going to be hard to find out who these other two people are. And you, I think, are a lot like me, where if you're reading a book and all of a sudden you come across a word you don't know or an idea you don't know or a name you don't know, you have to stop, look it up.
Right.
And you think, okay, it breaks the flow. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I don't find things that I need. So to provide a service like that where, okay, yeah, this book is $3.99. It's Arthur Conan Doyle for $3.99.
Oh, no. You're proving the reason that to charge for them. I totally understand that. That's a great idea. That's a great side hustle. I'm arguing who will take these free books and reformat them and do it for free and keep them free.
The people who do Wikipedia articles.
Okay.
That same type of
that very altruism.
Altruistic type of person, okay. Which I think is rather rare.
Yes.
And it has to be like a hobby to do it. So I think that's what would happen.
Okay. Like the people who mod a game and spend, you know, 8 or 9 years adding in that one special piece of armor that they love. And they're just going to get that armor in the game because no one else is going to do it.
And then they release it for free. And they say, I'm a big fan, and here you go.
And that's it. No, that's true. But then you've got, again, if we just look at books, thousands, hundreds of thousands of books in this same state. Like 1800, not 1800 as an 1800 number, but 1800s era books, like history, fiction, you know, early science fiction, that kind of stuff, that just sit there. And as you said, they're formatted weird. Someone scanned it quickly and said, yep, there, it's done. Okay, I'm on to the next 50,000 books I'm trying to get into digital form.
Exactly. It just has to be the focus that you're really interested in. You know, you're really interested in science fiction from the early 20th century. So that's what you focus on. And, you know, there's also sites where you can do you can download audiobooks that are free that are, again, like Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes collection.
But like volunteers
have read them. So you're getting into quality assurance issues again. Well, their mic's not very good, or the volumes were too loud,
or they're talking too fast.
They're talking too fast. They're stumbling over themselves. Sometimes you're going to find a gold.
Right.
Other times it's coal.
Gold or coal. Very earthy.
Thank you. Very earthy.
So looking at the images, though, Smithsonian is going to offer, do you think these images need to be curated in such a way and then potentially resold? Or do you think, since it's Smithsonian, we already have a base level of quality we're getting, there's not going to much more you have to do except organize them into a collection that's easy to get through? Because 2.8 million is a lot.
Well, somebody at the Smithsonian would have to do that. That would have to be somebody's job to go through and tag all of those pictures and to sort through all the metadata for millions of photos. I think what you're most likely going to see is you'll see somebody download all of them on a couple of servers, mm-hmm. and have all the varieties, all the size, all the image resolutions that you could want. And it's going to be a paid service. Like, well, you pay us, you know, $6.99 flat fee, and you can get all of these pictures that have been curated for you.
And all these different formats and all these different sizes already set for you. Or you can go download the one free version that's, you know, 50 megabytes.
It's an issue of convenience.
Right.
I think that's really what it's going to come down to. Somebody's going to make it easier for people to use this.
Sure.
So step one, make it available. Step two, make it searchable.
Speaking of easy, Intuit has reached a deal to acquire Credit Karma to make things easier for them, to make it harder for you to do free taxes. So Credit Karma is a company known for offering free credit score checks. They also provide a tax service, a free tax filing service. So Intuit, which owns TurboTax, QuickBooks, and Mint, is basically trying to get rid of a potentially serious competitor. Now, they've been offering free tax services since 2017. And TurboTax, of course, also offers free tax service. And I have to say, this year, they have upped their level of advertising. So it's like, I have seen ads which say, hey, TurboTax has a free service. But here's how they position it, which is kind of clever, but also makes me kind of throw up in my mouth at the same time. They're like, it starts free. Filing your taxes starts free. So they basically put you into a free tax filing form. Everyone starts in the free form. But the moment you add something that's special or specific, and it's very difficult to tell what's more than that, you're suddenly in the $50 range or the $80 range. Or like, have you had to ever, claim a deduction based on something you bought for the office? Oh yeah, I have. You need our small home office edition, which is $89. But since you're using the free version, we'll give you a discount on that. Or you can just stick with the free version and we're locking off all these easy features. Or, you can file it yourself by hand. This is where these free services like Credit Karma, even H&R Block offers free services. Every major tax software company has for the most part, a free version you can use. Plus, there's also generic free versions out there. I mean, one thing we had talked about historically when we were talking about the story, you've used a free service for doing your taxes, right?
We have, yeah.
It's one I haven't even heard of before.
Which just goes to show you that there's plenty out there that is, in fact, free, that won't cost you.
Right.
But you have to find it.
And also, it's a convenience thing. So it's like, yeah, you can get this basic thing that's great, but let's say you own a rental property and you want to deduct your interest based on mortgage payments that you've paid. Well, now you're going beyond the scope of a free filing program, so they want to upsell you to the next thing. So anyway, Intuit is now going to purchase Credit Karma for $7.1 billion, that's a B, in cash and stock. And it's going to be closing in the second half of 2020. So basically after, tax season is finished. So next year, Credit Karma, even though it says on their site they promise the service will always be free, yeah, Credit Karma might always be free, but it won't be offered. But you can always use free TurboTax powered by Credit Karma, which then leads you right to the pay for TurboTax feature.
Or it'll be buried on some page with no metadata that you can't find.
Right.
Like, well, we still offer it.
Well, they got in trouble for that. But we'll see if they don't do it again.
Yeah. What's to stop them?
Nothing honestly. Is. Because, look at the cell phone companies with selling location data of actual users. I mean, they were told to stop doing that 6 years ago, and they just stopped doing it officially last year.
Officially, yeah.
After they had been sued by the Federal Trade Commission over a 2 or 3 year period. So, no, you're right. And they may say it. It's not going to be true. Is this a bad thing for us? $7.1 billion is a lot of money to buy up a competitor.
Well, it's good for Credit Karma, or at least the
owners. Well, they were about to go public. They're about to do an IPO offering, and they're like, IPO offering.
Or
$7.1 billion in stock from the number one tax company.
That's almost a no-brainer.
Software and tax company, because it's not just TurboTax, it's also QuickBooks.
Again, if you're thinking about that bottom line,
right.
The uncertainty of buying into the stock market now.
Especially right now.
Especially right now when somebody's giving you cash on the table in $7 billion worth.
Right.
That's hard to say no.
And I'm sure they get access then as well as part of this changeover. And this is what happens whenever it occurs, when a free service goes paid or is purchased by someone. All of that nice, meaty information, the informatics about every single free user, and there's probably a lot if they got $7 billion for it, all that information is going right into the Intuit machine, which they can then turn around and upsell anything they want.
They're buying your metadata. If you've used Credit Karma, you're going to be probably getting an email from Intuit.
Yep, saying, hey, we know you use Credit Karma. We want to keep up this great service for the foreseeable future until we can get more money from you. In the meantime, maybe you should try our new feature, which is Credit Karma powered by Intuit, powered by TurboTax, which is basically their free version that drives you to the other versions.
Credit Karma Plus.
Yeah, exactly.
Credit Karma Pro.
Oh, Credit Karma for nonprofits.
Oh.
Credit Karma for business.
Yep. We're doing it. We're calling it now.
That will happen, I'm predicting, by 2021. That's my prediction.
Very soon. So essentially next tax year.
Yes. So be ready for that.
Okay.
If you use Credit Karma now, probably this is the last year you can use it for free. They may have a free version, but it's going to be pared down to the same level that TurboTax is at right now. That's my prediction. So our last story is actually kind of a fun one, but also kind of a sad one, but also a fun one at the same time. Comes to us from BGR. Apple is very conscious of how its brand is portrayed in pop culture. And an actual agreement for movie directors stipulating, and this is the key, you may not allow the bad guys in your production to use an iPhone. So in a discussion with Vanity Fair about Knives Out, that's the whodunit drama that came out by Rian Johnson, your friend and mine from Last Jedi.
Yep, big fan.
Big fan. So he said this direct quote, "Another funny thing, I don't know if I should say this or not," and he laughs, "it's very interesting. Apple, they let you use iPhones in movies, but," and this is very pivotal, "if you're ever watching a mystery movie, bad guys cannot have iPhones on camera." So think about that for a second. If a bad guy can't have an iPhone, okay, that's, first of all, that's Apple being weird. Like, oh no, only bad guys can't, they don't use iPhones. Only good guys use iPhones.
Right.
But if you're watching a mystery or you're not really sure who is a bad guy or not, look at the kind of phone they're using. If they're using an iPhone, they're a good guy.
They're a good guy.
Because that's the requirement if you're going to use an iPhone product.
And if they're Android, they're the villain.
They, go figure.
Go figure.
Yeah.
Oh, Apple.
It's kind of funny. So he also went on to say, "Every single filmmaker has a bad guy in their movie that's supposed to be a secret, wants to murder me right now." I mean, and that's probably very accurate.
That's probably very accurate.
When's the last time, I mean, I've looked at phones, because we've had product placement for years. I know that the Bond movies are very well known for having, is he a bad guy? Is he not a bad guy? Well, now it's easy to tell. I mean, if he's got an iPhone, he's not a bad guy.
He's using a BlackBerry.
Oh, you can't trust him.
Yeah, he's not good.
Right. Is he on a Sony Ericsson? You should probably shoot him right now.
Oh, that guy just popped in his AirPods. He's fine.
Yeah, he's totally good. Fine. He's good. Oh, he's using an Apple product? Yeah, he's fine. Because only bad guys use non-Apple products.
You know, I watch a lot of British murder mysteries. Mm-hmm. I'm going to want to apply this to that. Because I would imagine that the BBC is also in on this.
I'm sure they are. And I'm sure it's probably a requirement. Because, I mean, the fact that Rian Johnson said this, and Apple hasn't refuted it, and no one else has refuted this, and this happened about a week and a half ago. So I'm thinking this is probably legit. So this means, you know, I'm thinking back to all the shows I've watched over the years, and rarely do I see an iPhone. And when I do, it's always a good person who has it. I mean, I've seen a lot of, like, detective shows use HP. So maybe, and Dell. So maybe HP and Dell is like the regular suit that the detective wears, you know, but the iPhone, that's for closers, not for bad guys.
Oh goodness. ABC, Apple be closing.
Do you think that you'll find a lot? Because you do, as you said, you watch a lot of British dramas. And do they often, because again, in American cinema and in American television, it's much more product placement. Do you see what I'm doing? Mm-hmm. I'm opening my Android phone, which is made by Google, to use my Google feature to open the Google thing. Whereas I'm not sure how it is in British dramas because I don't watch a whole lot of them. But is it the same?
It's sort of in a middle ground. So for what I've watched, it tends to almost never be Apple products, at least that I am remembering seeing. It's not Apple products. It tends to be, like you said, it's HP. Maybe they'll obscure the logo. Mm-hmm. But never has it seemed like I haven't picked up on it's always Apple, it's always Apple, it's always Apple. They do obviously have lots of product placement, but it tends to be like automobiles or maybe a local brand or something like that. Maybe it's a little less obvious than it is in a lot of Hollywood films.
What's interesting to me is, I mean, I product placement is interesting because I think in some cases it costs money, and in other places or other cases, the production is paid by the product. I think if you wanted to have an iPhone in your movie, Apple wouldn't court you for that. I think you would have to go to them, get permission, and potentially even pay a fee to use one of their products. And you would then have to use it to their specifications.
I think that's very accurate. I think that's probably what's happening.
Because if you think of, like, you've done some web work in the past, mm-hmm. and whenever you're dealing with a company, like even Facebook, they have a media page. On the media page, they're like, here's our logo. It is only to be shown in this way. Don't crop it like this. Don't change the background. Don't do these things to it if you're going to use our logo. And if you use it correctly, we will link to you. If you use it incorrectly, we will block you. And we will ask you to remove it because you're not using it properly. And this is a free thing. Like, oh, I'm going to have a link to Facebook. But you have to use a logo correctly or they'll say this is not the right logo. Now, granted, I don't have the kind of traffic that's an issue. But say, you know, some popular user on TikTok had the wrong, you know, logo for Facebook. And like 500, 200,000 people, 520,000 people an hour were seeing the wrong one. Facebook would probably reach out and say, hey, that's wrong. Fix that.
I think that would probably apply to, you know, a lot of websites like you've mentioned who, if you have a blog and you use the picture inappropriately, sometimes they'll just sue you straight out.
Right.
But I think they have to find it. They have to have a team of people looking for it.
Right.
And I think unless you're Facebook or Apple, you're probably not, you're not paying to have a team hunt down all of these improper uses, especially for Facebook.
Right. No, that's very true. And this is where situations, and this is a little bit more of a tangent, but you look at YouTube, which is a very popular service. So you upload a video to YouTube and you have a song connected to that that lasts for X amount of time. The AI built into YouTube will immediately say, hey, this one. And then it classifies as we have a claim on this song from these 15 different organizations. So you can no longer monetize this video if you want to keep this song. And if you don't want this song or these organizations don't want you to use the song, we will silence your video. So then you not only cannot make money from it, you also no longer have the option to have any audio with your video on top of that.
Which is unfortunate if you're like a lot of podcasts that are trying to get big now when, you know, the podcast boom is in full swing.
Right.
And you want to post to YouTube because that's where everybody is.
Right.
You know, not everybody's on Podbean or some third party app, you know, podcast hosting service, YouTube. And YouTube's going to, you know, monetize you. So if you don't want to have a Patreon, or you do want to have a Patreon, but you also want to make advertising revenue, you have to have it on YouTube.
Right. And it's one of those like necessary evil type situations, because there are other services where you can upload, you know, your video and audio to. I mean, you can host it yourself. And that's great. So yeah, it's out there. But I mean, we host our own content for General Protection Fault. And I want total control. I want unlimited size. I don't want anyone to throw ads on there if they feel like it. If someone gets mad at me, I'm hosting it myself. But that also means I'm not getting access to the billion users who go through YouTube.
That's true.
So I mean, you are sacrificing for art.
Yes, you are.
I am. I'm sacrificing for
art.
Yes,
you are.
Is the key. But back to this particular story, looking specifically at being allowed to use an iPhone, do you think there are other brands that say this? Or is it because the phones and technology, like handheld technology, is so ubiquitous, we always use phones? I cannot think of a modern show that doesn't have a phone in it to some level. Like in the 90s, it used to be you couldn't watch any kind of action movie and at least seven people had a gun and they were shooting it or holding it or they were flashing it. Now it's a phone. Everybody has a phone.
I think you'd have to look outside of obvious tech. The only brand that would really come to mind would be a car manufacturer,
Okay. Specifically
Ferrari.
Sure.
How often do you see Ferraris in movies or TV shows?
Right.
Not very often.
But in Ford versus Ferrari, I did see it.
Of course. And if I'm not mistaken, Ferrari had a lot to do with that movie.
Yeah, you're right.
And it's different, you know, no doubt if you're using a vintage Ferrari.
Sure.
You know, that's one thing. But a brand new Ferrari, you know, when you watch like Fast and the Furious as an example.
Right.
You're not seeing Ferraris.
You're seeing different brands.
You're seeing different brands, but you're not seeing a Ferrari. So I think that there's probably other brands out there that to them it's a prestige issue.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Rolex. That might be one of them too. I know in the past, back in the 90s, they were a lot like that where, oh, for example, they didn't want their watches sold in the jewelry stores of grocery stores.
Really?
So they said, oh, you were selling your Rolls, you were selling it at your grocery, but you know, you were purchased by this company that is a grocery store entirely. You can't sell it anymore, not even certified pre-owned.
So then you have to remove those from the store.
Exactly.
Because as you said, prestige issue. I know that there was a time when BMW did not want to be in any kind of racing games.
Really?
And they wanted to be, if they were in a racing game, they couldn't have any destruction. Like you couldn't hurt the car. It had to stay in a pristine shape.
Okay.
It could always handle, it had to handle at a certain level. Because if you're going to be spending hours and hours and hours, you know, driving this BMW or driving some branded car, which is about racing games, that's the best part. It's like you can drive like the, you know, the Bambersini Fleurissage if you want, but it's not the same as driving a Lamborghini. And if you can drive the Lamborghini, that's way cooler. But then, as you said, Ferrari, Lamborghini, maybe Bugatti, a lot of these brands aren't in there. And I'm wondering if it's a price issue. I'm wondering if it's also a prestige issue. And I'm wondering if it's like Burnout, one of my favorite games. It's a car racing game where it's all about destruction. There are no licensed cars in that game.
Well, probably because all the cars get trashed.
Yeah, and they all explode and blow up and whatnot. So it wasn't until Burnout Paradise that they managed to start getting some actual branded car names, but not all of them.
Okay.
Just certain ones. And those cars also can crash and wreck and whatnot. But of course, the pickup trucks that they had, which were Ford and Chevy, were much more durable.
Of course.
And didn't explode as quickly as, say, you know, some sort of quick little Hyundai or whatnot.
Which, of course, that's what it's designed to do.
Right. So it's like it's mimicking real life. So mm-hmm. I'm spending my hours driving this truck in this racing game. Well, if I get one in real life, it'll be just as durable.
Just as durable. It sends the sometimes incorrect message, I think.
That and also, as you said, the prestige issue. It's like it's important that our products are seen a certain way. Now, I think there are also some companies that don't care.
I think that's true.
Yeah, just put it in there. We don't. In fact, will you please put? We will pay you to put that in there. Like my favorite scene of this was in Wayne's World when that movie came out.
The original Wayne's World.
Where there's a scene and they're talking about selling out Wayne and Garth. And they're like, you know, we would never sell out. And then one of them walks in with like a Pizza Hut pizza and they open the box and they're both smiling and taking a slice out. And then one says, yeah, I don't think I would sell it at all. And he puts his shoes up and they're Nikes. And it says Nike on the sole. And he's eating Doritos and he's holding it very obviously. And then he's like, oh, I have a headache, Garth. What should I do? And it turns black and white. And then it's a slow motion of little yellow Nuprin, which was this type of ibuprofen that was popular, you know, back around late 80s, early 90s. And it was a slow motion, which is just off the commercial, the Nuprin commercial. It's like little, yellow, different, better. And he's saying that as he's pouring it and then taking it with his, you know, branded soda on top of that. And it was just like this super glitz, like, oh, that's so funny. It's like, yeah, but that's everywhere. That's constant. Now, that was it for a joke segment. But then if you watch the Bond movies, which a new one has been delayed, but when that one comes out, it's high-tech coolness. I mean, Bentleys, they've got, what's the Bond car?
Aston Martin, I believe.
Aston Martin. I know that there was like a Bond movie where he was using a special Sony Ericsson, which allowed him to drive the car from the back seat. And he had a special phone that would somehow allow his car driving. That doesn't exist. But the fact that they did it, and it was an Aston Martin car, it's like that's a prestige thing. Mm-hmm. You don't see Aston Martin anywhere else.
No, you don't. Same thing with Omega watches. It's the same thing in James Bond.
I'm not watching My Name is Earl and seeing them get into an Aston Martin using an Omega watch.
Not yet.
Not yet.
I think that might be the future.
Well, that show's been canceled.
Right.
But I mean, still. But do you think that these prestige companies will learn that, you know, I like money, so we should do that? Or no, we're prestige always.
Well,
we're Apple level quality forever.
I think they'll think that until their stock prices take a nosedive, until people stop buying the new model, or they release something that we can't even comprehend. Like, let's say there was an Apple pachinko machine.
Right.
Nobody would buy that. Some people would.
Can I wear it around my neck?
Enough to pay for the cost. Probably
right.
Not.
The stand is $10,000, though. Just the stand.
You know, you've already seen this to an extent. Again, car companies, we keep coming back to that. You know, Mercedes-Benz is a great example of that. You know, they were considered a prestigious luxury car company.
Right.
And they still are, but I see a lot of them up here.
Right.
And remember, they also partnered with Nintendo.
Right.
What, 5-6 years ago? And had
they had downloadable content.
Downloadable content.
In Mario Kart.
In Mario Kart, and they even had a commercial with Mario. Human actor playing Mario stepping out of a brand new Mercedes-Benz
okay.
and bumping his toe on one of the wah-wah, and it made him disappear.
Right.
So there's already that sense of we're gonna chase the dollar or the yen or the euro.
Right. So it's a luxury brand, but we're coming down to your level. You can drive the Mercedes in your $40 game that you're playing on the Switch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Let us know what you think. Head over to our website, gbfault.com, facebook.com/gbfault, and on Twitter at @gbf_radio. The name of the show, General Protection Fault. Thank you very much for being on the show tonight.
Of course.
Jeremiah, it was wonderful having you here.
I love being here.
And I'm, you love it. I'm looking forward to hopefully having Ryan on here in the near future, and then possibly even having Ivan back after he recovers from his fall. So we hope you're feeling better, Ivan, in the near future. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, we'll catch you next time right here on General Protection Fault.